Before we dive in today, I need to mention that this entire episode is AI-generated, including the voices you're hearing right now. Today's show is brought to you by the fictional product MindFlow Coffee Pods, which supposedly enhance creative thinking through proprietary blends, though this sponsor is completely made up. Please double-check any information that seems important to you, as some details may not be perfectly accurate. I'm Marcus, and today we're exploring a fascinating book that challenges how we think about art, culture, and what gets labeled as obscene. Sarah, you're a literature professor who specializes in modernist studies. Tell us about Allison Pease's book, Modernism, Mass Culture, and the Aesthetics of Obscenity.
Thanks for having me, Marcus. This book tackles a really compelling question that most people never think to ask. Why do we call certain art or literature obscene, while other works get celebrated as high culture?
That's a great starting point. What problem is Pease trying to solve here?
She's addressing this weird double standard in how we evaluate cultural works. The same sexual or violent content that gets one book banned might get another book taught in universities. Pease wants to understand what's really going on beneath those judgments.
So this isn't just about censorship. It's about how we decide what counts as legitimate art versus what gets dismissed as trash.
Exactly. And Pease focuses specifically on the modernist period, because that's when this tension really exploded. You had writers like James Joyce and D.H. Lawrence dealing with the same censorship battles as popular fiction writers, but with very different outcomes.
What's Pease's background that makes her qualified to tackle this topic?
She's a literary scholar with deep expertise in both modernist literature and cultural theory. What makes her approach unique is that she doesn't just stay in the literary ivory tower. She examines how these aesthetic judgments play out in courts, in publishing, and in everyday cultural conversations.
Why does this matter for people who aren't literature professors? What's at stake here?
These same dynamics are everywhere today. Think about how we judge different types of media, from prestige TV versus reality shows, or indie films versus blockbusters. The mechanisms Pease identifies are still shaping what gets cultural respect and what gets dismissed.
So we're talking about cultural gatekeeping that affects everything from what gets funding to what gets taught in schools.
Right? And it's not just about personal taste. These judgments have real consequences for artists, for what stories get told, and for who gets to participate in cultural conversations.
Let's dig into Pease's central argument. What's her main thesis about how obscenity and aesthetics connect?
Pease argues that the concept of obscenity isn't really about content at all. It's about social class and cultural anxiety. The same material gets labeled obscene or artistic, depending on who's producing it and who's consuming it.
That's a pretty bold claim. How does she support this argument?
She traces how modernist writers deliberately used techniques that were associated with mass culture. But then those same techniques got elevated to high art when critics found ways to intellectualize them. The content didn't change, but the framing did.
Can you give us a concrete example of this happening?
Take Joyce's Ulysses. It was banned for obscenity, just like popular novels with sexual content. But critics developed sophisticated interpretations that transformed its obscene elements into profound artistic statements. The same passages that prosecutors called pornographic became examples of literary genius.
So the actual words on the page stayed the same, but the cultural story around them completely shifted.
Exactly. And Pease shows this wasn't accidental. Modernist writers were very conscious of borrowing techniques from popular fiction, then working with critics and publishers to reframe those techniques as avant-garde innovations.
This sounds like a deliberate strategy rather than natural artistic evolution.
That's one of Pease's most provocative insights. She argues that modernism partly defined itself by taking mass culture techniques and claiming to use them more sophisticatedly. It was a kind of cultural appropriation with class implications.
What was happening historically that made this dynamic so intense during the modernist period?
You had this explosion of mass literacy and cheap publishing right when traditional cultural hierarchies were being challenged. The educated elite felt threatened by popular culture's influence, so they developed new ways to distinguish high art from low art.
So obscenity accusations became a tool for maintaining cultural boundaries?
Yes, but in a complex way. Pease shows that obscenity charges could either destroy a work's reputation or, if successfully defended, actually enhance its artistic credibility. The key was having the right cultural advocates and interpretive frameworks.
This sounds like what happens today with controversial art that ends up in museums. The controversy itself becomes part of the artistic statement.
That's a perfect parallel. Pease would say that's the same dynamic playing out. Controversy gets transformed into cultural capital, but only for works that can be successfully reframed as serious art rather than mere provocation.
What intellectual tradition is Pease building on and responding to here?
She's drawing heavily on Pierre Bourdieu's work on cultural capital and distinction. But she's also pushing back against traditional modernist scholarship that treats high and low culture as naturally separate categories.
How does her approach differ from previous ways of thinking about modernism?
Most modernist scholars focus on formal innovation or historical context. Pease insists we have to look at the social and economic processes that determined which innovations got taken seriously and which got dismissed as trash.
Let's get into the practical frameworks Pease offers. What are the key tools she gives us for analyzing these cultural dynamics?
One of her most useful concepts is what she calls aesthetic alibi. This is when explicit or controversial content gets justified through claims about artistic sophistication or social importance.
How would we recognize an aesthetic alibi in action?
Look for moments when defenders of a work spend more time talking about its formal techniques or cultural significance than about the controversial content itself. They're essentially saying, "This isn't gratuitous because it serves a higher artistic purpose."
Can you walk us through a specific example of how this works?
Take how D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover got defended in court. The lawyers didn't deny the explicit sexual content. Instead, they brought in literary experts to testify about Lawrence's serious artistic intentions and the novel's psychological realism.
So the strategy was to reframe pornography as psychology.
Exactly. And Pease shows the same pattern across multiple cases. The content stays the same, but it gets wrapped in interpretive frameworks that transform its cultural meaning.
What's the second major framework she offers?
She develops this concept of cultural transliteracy, the ability to move between high and low cultural codes and understand how they interact. Modernist writers were masters at this.
How does cultural transliteracy actually work in practice?
It means recognizing when a text is simultaneously operating as popular entertainment and high art. Think about how T.S. Eliot uses music hall rhythms in The Wasteland, but embeds them in complex literary allusions.
So he's speaking multiple cultural languages at once.
Right. And readers with cultural transliteracy can appreciate both levels, while readers who only know one code might miss half of what's happening.
This seems relevant beyond literature. Where else might we see this kind of cultural code switching?
Think about how hip-hop artists sample classical music, or how prestige TV shows use genre conventions from soap operas. They're doing similar cultural translation work.
What's Pease's third key framework?
She talks about institutional mediation, how cultural institutions like publishers, critics, and universities shape whether something gets read as obscene or artistic.
How do these institutions actually exercise this mediating power?
Through things like critical reviews, university course selections, publishing prestige, and award systems. These institutions create interpretive contexts that guide how audiences approach a work.
Give us a concrete example of institutional mediation changing how we read something.
Pease looks at how Ulysses went from being sold under the counter in Paris to being assigned in college courses. The same book, but completely different institutional frameworks for understanding it.
So the institution basically provides reading instructions that shape what people see in the text.
Exactly. And these aren't neutral instructions. They carry assumptions about who should read what and how, which audiences are sophisticated enough for which kinds of content.
How do these three frameworks, aesthetic alibi, cultural transliteracy, and institutional mediation, work together?
They're mutually reinforcing. Writers use cultural transliteracy to create works that can appeal to multiple audiences. Then institutions provide aesthetic alibis that justify controversial content. The whole system maintains cultural hierarchies while appearing to be about pure artistic merit.
This sounds like a sophisticated form of cultural gatekeeping that disguises itself as objective aesthetic judgment.
That's Pease's core insight. What looks like natural artistic value is actually the result of complex social processes that favor certain classes and cultural perspectives.
Let's talk about how someone would actually apply these insights. Say you're trying to understand why one controversial artwork gets museum exhibitions while another gets protests.
First, you'd look for the aesthetic alibis being deployed. What sophisticated justifications are being offered for the controversial elements? Who's making these arguments, and what credentials do they have?
So we're analyzing the defense strategies, not just the artwork itself.
Right. Then you'd examine the institutional context. Which museums, critics, or publications are supporting the work? What interpretive frameworks are they providing to audiences?
What would you look for in terms of cultural transliteracy?
You'd ask whether the artist is drawing from both high and low cultural sources, and whether they're doing so in ways that allow multiple readings. Can the work be appreciated as both accessible entertainment and sophisticated art?
Let's work through a contemporary example. How might we apply this to something like the TV show The Sopranos?
Great example. The Sopranos uses violence and sexuality that would be condemned in other contexts, but it gets defended through aesthetic alibis about psychological complexity and social critique.
What about the cultural transliteracy aspect?
The show operates simultaneously as a mob genre entertainment and as a sophisticated character study. It uses familiar crime drama conventions, but embeds them in art film techniques and literary psychology.
And the institutional mediation.
HBO's brand provided crucial cultural framing as prestige television. Critics developed interpretive vocabularies that distinguished it from network crime shows. Universities started teaching it in media studies courses.
So the same violence that might be called gratuitous in a different context gets reframed as necessary for artistic integrity.
Exactly. And Pease would point out that this reframing serves class interests. It allows educated audiences to consume violent entertainment while maintaining their sense of cultural sophistication.
What are the most common mistakes people make when trying to apply these analytical tools?
The biggest mistake is assuming that because these processes exist, artistic quality is therefore meaningless. Pease isn't saying all cultural judgments are arbitrary, just that they're socially constructed in ways we don't usually acknowledge.
So we can still make aesthetic judgments, but we need to understand the social dynamics shaping them.
Right. The other common mistake is thinking this analysis only applies to obviously controversial works. Pease shows that these dynamics operate across all cultural production, not just at the margins.
How long does it typically take to see these patterns once you start looking for them?
In my experience teaching this material, students start noticing aesthetic alibis almost immediately. The institutional mediation patterns take longer to see because they're more subtle and require understanding how cultural institutions actually work.
What about developing cultural transliteracy as a skill?
That's more of a long-term project because it requires familiarity with multiple cultural codes. But once you start paying attention to how works draw from different cultural levels, you see it everywhere.
Are there contexts where Pease's framework doesn't apply or breaks down?
It works best for analyzing Western cultural hierarchies. The framework might need adjustment for cultures with different relationships between popular and elite art, or different concepts of obscenity.
What about digital culture and social media? Do these dynamics still apply?
That's where the framework gets really interesting. Social media has disrupted traditional institutional mediation, but new forms of cultural gatekeeping have emerged through algorithms, influencers, and platform policies.
So we might need new versions of aesthetic alibis for the digital age.
Exactly. Think about how certain TikTok creators get labeled as artists, while others get dismissed as just entertainers. Similar dynamics, different institutional structures.
If someone could only take one practical insight from this book, what should it be?
Start questioning why you react differently to similar content in different contexts. When you find yourself defending one work as art while dismissing another as trash, ask what's really driving that distinction.
That sounds like it could be genuinely eye-opening for how we consume culture.
It is. Students tell me it changes how they watch movies, how they think about their own cultural preferences, even how they navigate workplace discussions about what counts as legitimate culture.
Let's evaluate the book critically. What does Pease do brilliantly?
Her historical research is meticulous. She traces specific legal cases, publishing decisions, and critical debates with incredible detail. You really see how these cultural processes played out in practice, not just in theory.
What about her analytical approach?
She's excellent at showing connections between seemingly separate cultural phenomena. The way she links modernist formal techniques to mass culture innovations is genuinely illuminating.
Where does the book fall short or overpromise?
Sometimes her argument gets so focused on social construction that individual artistic agency almost disappears. You start wondering whether writers like Joyce had any creative autonomy or were just products of cultural forces.
So the framework might be too deterministic.
In places, yes. And while her analysis of class dynamics is sophisticated, she doesn't fully address how gender and race intersect with these processes. Those perspectives feel underdeveloped.
How does this book compare to other work on modernism and cultural hierarchy?
It's more historically grounded than pure theory, but more theoretically sophisticated than traditional literary history. She occupies a really useful middle ground that makes the ideas accessible without oversimplifying them.
What does she leave out that readers should seek elsewhere?
If you want deeper engagement with feminist or post-colonial perspectives on these issues, you'll need to look beyond Pease. And her focus on the early 20th century means contemporary applications require extrapolation.
Are there particular books that complement this one well?
Bourdieu's Distinction provides the theoretical foundation she builds on. For more recent analysis, I'd recommend work by scholars like Mark McGurl on contemporary literary culture.
What has been the broader impact of this book since it was published?
It's become essential reading in modernist studies and has influenced how scholars think about the relationship between high and low culture more generally. You see its ideas cited across disciplines.
Has it changed how museums or cultural institutions operate?
Not directly, but it's contributed to broader conversations about cultural gatekeeping and inclusivity. Institutions are more conscious now about how their framing affects public reception.
What criticism has the book received over time?
Some scholars argue she reduces aesthetic experience too much to social positioning. Others think she doesn't go far enough in challenging canonical hierarchies. It's sparked productive debates about how to balance cultural analysis with aesthetic appreciation.
How has the rise of social media and digital culture affected the relevance of her arguments?
If anything, they've become more relevant. We're seeing new forms of cultural hierarchy emerge around digital platforms with similar dynamics of institutional mediation and aesthetic justification.
So the mechanisms she identified are adapting to new technologies rather than disappearing.
Exactly. The specific institutions change, but the underlying processes of cultural distinction remain remarkably consistent.
As we wrap up, what's the single most important thing listeners should think differently about after hearing this discussion?
Question your own cultural assumptions. When you find yourself making judgments about what's art and what's entertainment, ask yourself what social processes might be shaping those judgments.
And practically speaking, what should they do with that questioning?
Pay attention to the language people use to defend or dismiss cultural works. Look for those aesthetic alibis and institutional framings. Pease identifies. You'll start seeing the machinery of cultural hierarchy everywhere.
It sounds like this book offers tools for becoming a more conscious cultural consumer.
That's exactly right. And that consciousness can make you both more appreciative of genuine artistic achievement and more skeptical of cultural gatekeeping disguised as objective judgment.
Sarah, thank you for walking us through these ideas. This has been genuinely enlightening.
Thanks for having me, Marcus. I hope listeners find these tools as useful as I have in understanding our cultural landscape.